Humility. It's a key to navigating our differences in these toxically divided times. So how did this virtue show up for one of America's greatest leaders?
He knew that humility is realizing there's something larger than oneself. It's an ideal, it's democracy, it's God.
And how could a lack of humility end up hurting our relationships today?
Maybe one of the reasons that it was so painful is because it kind of felt like karma. I was very familiar with that tactic of shutting somebody down because I had used it so much myself.
All this and more is just ahead. Welcome to A Braver Way, a show about how you, yes, you, can disagree about politics without losing heart. I'm Monica Guzman, your guide across the divide, to help you hear and be heard by people who confound you. We don't want to be at war in our country. We want to be at home. So strap in, because it's time we learn how to turn up the heat, turn down the fear, and get real about things that matter with more of our fellow Americans than we thought possible. Hey everyone, so here it is, a new podcast, Wild. I'm so glad you're joining me for it. We called it A Braver Way because this whole thing takes courage, getting heard across the political divide. And courage, if you checked out the snazzy graphic in our podcast feed, it's about heart. But not the cute, touchy-feely kind of heart. More like the bloody, beating thing that keeps us all going, that puts red and blue into a very necessary kind of communication inside each one of us. The root of the word courage is cor, the Latin word for heart. Is there a braver way to be honest, passionate, humble, and yeah, even angry about politics with each other? Definitely. And that's what we're here to talk about. In each episode, you'll hear me in conversation with guests who have big things to teach us about how to confront the chasms in our politics. I'll check in on what it all means for conservatives, liberals, and everyone in between with my brilliant friend, April Lawson, the director of Braver Angels Debates and a red to my blue. And finally, you'll hear the story of someone we've met who's changed the way they face the divide, like Jade, whose voice you heard at the start of this episode. Now, when I was racking my brain about who we had to talk to, someone who's shown serious courage crossing divides, I happened to glance at a page on the Braver Angels website and come face to face with a very obvious but impossible answer. Abraham Lincoln. I mean, if there's an icon of American political bridge building, Lincoln is it. He brought us through the Civil War, out of the moral atrocity of slavery, somehow kind of intact. I remember sitting in my middle school history class going, this guy could have been so much more angry, more vindictive. He had reasons. Everyone did. He could have torn us apart himself. Instead, we got a house divided against itself cannot stand. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Braver Angels based our name on Lincoln calling Americans to the better angels of our nature. If we're going to hold America together when there are so many reasons to fall apart, Lincoln is a model to follow. But here's the thing. I remember going to D.C. for the first time on a high school trip from New Hampshire, walking up to the Lincoln Memorial, looking way, way up at this giant marble man on a giant marble chair, and thinking, was this guy even real? We have his speeches, right? This case study in decorum and eloquence. But how did Lincoln, the human, actually do it? How did he disagree in everyday life on the most heated things you can imagine? Could he stand hearing from the other side? Did he ever get, I don't know, angry? Thinking about all this, I got a little obsessed. I started looking up books, articles. I wanted to know, who can fill us in, not on Lincoln the icon, but Lincoln the regular guy? given that I can't, you know, talk to the man directly. And that is how I found Ronald C. White. Ron is a New York Times best-selling author of books about some of the biggest figures in America. He's written 4 books on Lincoln alone. And his latest one, which I read in all of 3 days, is called Lincoln in Private: What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. Lincoln didn't keep a diary per se, but he did write random and sometimes really profound notes to himself over the course of his life. He'd stick them in his pockets, the drawers in his desk, these little scraps to help him think. 111 of them have survived for scholars to dive into. They're all in Ron's book. How did Lincoln disagree during that other most divisive time in America? And what can we learn from that? Here it is, my conversation with renowned historian Ronald C. White about renowned bridge builder Abraham Lincoln. Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Monty, it's great to be with you and your listeners. Thank you.
Yeah, totally. All right. The first thing I'm dying to know is you've written 4 books on Lincoln. You've spent a couple decades, I think, researching him and going into history. What drew you so powerfully to Abraham Lincoln?
Well, how could a person with less than 1 year of formal education write these great speeches, the Gettysburg Address, the second inaugural address? How did he do that? I was just trying to imagine that. That got me started. I've always been interested in public speaking, and I want to know, how did he write these great speeches? That was the beginning.
So in your book, Lincoln in Private, which I devoured this week, and I'm not exaggerating, one of your first notes was about Lincoln the lawyer, and Lincoln was a lawyer some quarter century or so.
Right.
Tell us about that note and what it shows us about how he disagreed.
Yes, Lincoln served in public office 14 years, but as you suggested, he served as a lawyer 24 years. So after his single term in Congress, in which he took a very unpopular stand against the war with Mexico, he comes home, his friends say, thank you very much, we're not going to elect you again, and he becomes a full-time lawyer. But he wanted to give a lecture to lawyers. He couldn't work with them as a mentor. But we don't think he ever actually gave the lecture. But these are his notes, and I want to read the first part of this lecture. It's just an amazing part.
It is.
I am not an accomplished lawyer. Wait a second.
Yeah, right.
He's already one of the great lawyers in the state of Illinois. But then the next sentence, I find quite as much material for a lecture in those points where I have failed as in those where I have been moderately successful. Can we imagine a modern politician saying, I find as much material in those points where I have failed? Part of what we're talking about here today is the willingness to admit when we have failed. And that opens up the conversation.
And you mentioned throughout the book a couple of key qualities that you pick up as a thread throughout the notes and throughout his life. And one of them is humility. So when I hear, I'm not an accomplished lawyer, I have more to teach you from my failure. Why was that a key quality? And what can we take away from Lincoln about how to be more humble?
Well, Monica, on his journey from Springfield to Washington, which took 13 days by train.
And this was when he had been elected already?
He'd been elected. So he was going to become the 16th president of the United States. And he spoke more than 100 times in various whistle stops. And 4 times in those talks, he said, I want to be, or I am, a humble instrument. So I think he knew that humility is realizing there's something larger than oneself. It's an ideal, it's democracy, it's God. And that's the basis of him. Not that he wasn't ambitious. He certainly was ambitious. You have to be ambitious to be a politician. But he could combine humility and politics. Let me tell you a story, if I can.
Please.
In 2019, I got an invitation just at the end of 3 or 4 months before COVID from the Library of Congress to speak to members of Congress. 24 people, congresspersons and spouses, accepted the invitation. And they gave me the topic talk about ambition and humility. And I said, how long should I speak? And they said, 10 minutes. I said, 10 minutes? They said, yes, members of Congress like to talk a lot.
Yeah.
When I talk, I often try to fix my gaze on two or three people. And I was watching this one woman in the audience. And as the talk ended and people rushed off to their offices, I noticed that she kind of lingered until she became the last person to come up and talk to me. She said, my husband has been a congressman for more than 20 years. He has decided to retire. I want to ask you this question. And then I noticed tears began to well up in her eyes.
Wow.
And she said to me, do you think it's possible that humility can ever return to American politics?
Oh, wow.
Do you think it's possible that humility will ever return to American politics?
Wow.
Obviously, as you see, I've never forgotten her question.
Oh, amazing. What did you say?
Oh my God, I was almost speechless. I saw the tears and I said, well, this is the great value that we need to re-understand and reinvent. And I think this is at the heart of why our politics have become so polarized.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that we'll come back to humility. I want to take us to a couple notes in the book about slavery.
Yes.
This was obviously an enormous issue in Lincoln's time, one that he spent so much of his life wrestling with. And the way he wrestled with the issue, I think, has a lot to teach us today. There's a note in there about where he kind of imagines an argument between two people who are on opposing sides of slavery, which is hard to imagine today.
Yeah.
Tell us about that note and what does it teach us about how Lincoln disagreed?
I said just a few minutes ago that he became a full-time lawyer. But in 1854, 5 years after he returned from Congress, the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed. And this act allowed the possibility that slavery could now extend west.
Because let me see if I get this right. The Missouri Compromise had put an agreement in place where north of this line, free states, south of this line, southern states, we're cool. But the Kansas-Nebraska Act said, you know what? We're going to add a couple of states to the union and we're going to break that rule and let them decide.
And let them decide. Can you vote on whether you want to have slavery? So Lincoln, who's been this lawyer for 5 years, is just furious over this possibility. But before he speaks publicly, this would be interesting, wouldn't it? Before our politicians speak publicly,
they might
take some time to think about the issue they're facing. And this is the way Lincoln thought about it. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may have right to enslave B, why may not B snatch the same argument and prove equally that he may enslave A? Ah, you say A is white and B is black. It is color, then, the lighter. And Lincoln underlines key words, so he underlines the word color.
I noticed that.
Color, then, the lighter, having the right to enslave the darker. Take care. By this rule, you are to be the slave of the first man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. This is Lincoln the lawyer, kind of parsing this out, trying to understand the point of view of the other. He goes on, but say you it's a question of interest. He really means economic interest. And if you can make it your economic interest, you have the right to enslave another. Very well. And if he can make it his interest, he has the right to enslave you. Now, Lincoln never used these words, Monica, in a speech. This was his intellectual thinking before he would speak publicly.
Mm-hmm. He was reflecting. He was testing. He was being a lawyer. And he was engaging with the ideas.
He was engaging with the idea. Terrific.
I think that these days, it's tempting to think that if I engage with an idea that I could become infected by it. I should not engage with that idea. It might be dangerous. It might be harmful. There's some really compelling ideas around this. And Lincoln's example really spoke to me because Lincoln was clearly against slavery. We see it in his private notes. No performance here.
Right.
He even subscribed to pro-slavery newspapers and read them. It sounds like his colleagues were like, what are you doing, man?
What are you doing? Yes, he comes home from Congress and his law partner, William Herndon, says, I think we should subscribe to some national anti-slavery magazines. And then Lincoln says to Herndon, but I also think we should subscribe to two of the leading Southern newspapers, And Herndon says, why would we do that?
Yeah.
He said, because we need both sides at the table. Our problem today is we are in silos. We listen to one side, one group to this channel, another side to this channel. In Lincoln's day, there were different channels. In Chicago, the Chicago Tribune was the Republican newspaper. The Chicago Times was the Democratic newspaper. But Lincoln wanted us to read both, to hear not just the way you or I might say the other person thinks. Let's hear it in their own words.
Mm.
And I think this says so much about Lincoln and how then he could actually bridge the divide, because
yeah.
he knew both sides of the argument.
You wrote in the book's epilogue, the more I studied the fragments, meaning these notes that Lincoln wrote to himself that have survived, the more impressed I grew with Lincoln's mental curiosity. So we talked about humility as a trait. Tell us about where you see curiosity come up for Lincoln, and how did he practice it?
I like that you're bringing this up. I think that intellectual curiosity is perhaps the greatest quality that we can derive from education. This is the kind of perspective of Lincoln that I think is most revealing of why he becomes a great leader. He always wanted to get inside of an argument. He's at age 40. He's traveling on the 8th Judicial Circuit in Illinois. He's reading Euclid's theorems. Why is he reading Euclid's theorems at age 40? Because he wants to further equip himself to think. This is part of his intellectual curiosity. And so I think this is a quality that I wish we could, if I were voting for a politician, I would sort of ask the question, is this person intellectually curious?
Wow. And it brings me back to,
Not just where did they go to school or what are their degrees, but are they intellectually curious? Yeah.
That was what I was thinking of, is we're a society that traffics in credentials today.
We are.
Right?
Yeah.
And again, you said that one of the questions that sort of drove you to be interested in Lincoln at all was, how did a guy with 1 year of formal schooling write something like the Second Inaugural,
yeah,
with malice toward none, with charity for all? How in the world did he write the Gettysburg Address? So I think you're saying it. He taught himself. Tell us about, there's a newspaper quote in the book, a newspaper in Illinois, I believe, that didn't favor Lincoln and sort of made fun of the fact that he's been nosing around in the library.
Right.
Do you remember this?
Yeah,
we've seen,
yeah,
Lincoln nosing around in the library, filling his head with stuff for his silly arguments. And I just laughed.
Yeah.
So how did his curiosity, do you think, serve him when it came to his opponents across these big ideas?
Well, he wanted to know what they really thought. He respected them. That's another quality that we want to put into this conversation, respect.
Yes.
So even though he debated Stephen Douglas 7 times, he deeply respected Stephen Douglas. And I tell this story, which I think is remarkable. After he defeats Stephen Douglas for the presidency, and he's there ready to give his inaugural speech, and the war has broken out, and Stephen Douglas is sitting on the platform, and Lincoln is not quite sure what to do with his tall hat and his manuscript and his cane. And Stephen Douglas steps forward and says, "Sir, may I hold these for you?" That Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's opponent, had come to have this incredible respect for Lincoln. Lincoln had earned that respect.
Yeah, imagine that, right? Seeing
imagine that
more in,
yeah,
our politics or in our,
right,
discourse, what it would,
right,
do,
right,
how it,
right,
could transform,
right,
us. Let's talk about anger.
Okay.
And you probably know where I'm going here. But there is a note where I saw something that does not line up with my vision of 1860s, you know, decorous statesman-like writing.
Right.
And Lincoln, in a private note to himself, is reflecting on and responding to a popular pro-slavery writer. And Lincoln wants to know about the other side, reads the book, and in this note is responding to Ross, was his name. But he is angry. He is clearly not the calm orator that we saw in public in this,
right,
note. And he ends the note by saying, and maybe you want to read it, actually. Why don't you read it?
And remember, thank you so much for introducing this. I think part of the purpose of these notes is to get out your anger now.
Right, in private.
not on CNN or Fox News, where you had about 2 minutes to think about it.
Or on Twitter.
On Twitter, yes. Frederick Ross was a Presbyterian minister who had written a best-selling book on slavery as ordained by God, arguing that slavery is in the Bible and therefore it's perfectly acceptable. And he starts out this note by saying, suppose it is true that the Negro is inferior to the white. You see, starting with the other person's point of view.
Right.
In the gifts of nature. Is it not the exact reverse justice that the white should, for that reason, take from the Negro any part of the little that has been given him? Give to him that is needy is the Christian rule of charity. Take from him that is needy is the rule of slavery. And then what you're referring to, and we get down to the end of the note, but slavery is good for some people? ! As a good thing, slavery is strikingly peculiar in this, that it is the only good thing which no man ever seeks the good of for himself.
Right.
And then this final paragraph. Nonsense! ! Wolves devouring lambs, not because it is good for their own greedy maws, but because it is good for the lambs, ! So yeah. Lincoln could become angry, but he read this book, which was counter to all of his ideas. He never talks about it in a public speech, but in his private notes, his private reminiscing, his private reflection, he wants to understand, but he's deeply angry with the author.
Yeah. So I said that I devoured your book this week. The other thing that I did that I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't done earlier is watch Lincoln, the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis playing Lincoln.
Yeah. I've watched it 7 times.
Oh, I can imagine. It's a good movie. Wow. Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis really became, anyway.
He's terrific.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
He lived the part, I'm told. He walked around 24 hours a day as Lincoln.
Yes, yeah. And I read something about how Daniel Day-Lewis walked as Lincoln was really accurate from what we know. So one of the things that that movie exhibits that appears to come from the historical record is that Lincoln loved illustrating his points with stories.
Yes.
And we have research these days that says things. For example, there was one study that said that showed that people respect each other's moral beliefs better when they come in the form of personal stories, personal experiences. We relate to each other. Tell us about this part of Lincoln.
Lincoln distinguished himself by his ability to be a public speaker. But to your point, he also was able to use ordinary kind of common stories of the day. They had a kind of a humor of that day, ordinary folk humor, not high humor. And this was a way that he could make his point.
Right. And you mentioned humor.
Yes.
Do you think
God.
Is this something that helped him? Is this something that we can cultivate at a time when our division seems so serious?
Yes.
Where does humor play a role?
There's a certain kind of humor. I think we use humor today, and even the late night comedians often do this, to put other people down.
Yeah.
For Lincoln, his humor was a self-deprecating humor. I love the story that as he's traveling about Illinois, he stops in a town. The fellow says, "Can I do your photograph?" He said, "Absolutely." But he said, "We need to straighten your hair." He said, "It's really a pretty askew." The guy then goes back and gets behind his camera. It takes quite a while to get the camera set up. And when he looks out, Lincoln has taken his hands and messed his hair all up again. And he said, "If I straighten my hair, people won't know who I am."
Amazing. That's just hilarious.
He laughed at himself.
Yes. Is there something in there, too, about authenticity?
That's a good word. I like that.
Yeah. Is there something about, I'm not pretending anything? What do you think?
This is who I am. Take it or leave it. I don't pretend to be the smartest person in the world. I don't pretend to have this. I don't pretend to have that.
Yeah.
But I am honest and I have integrity.
Yeah. So here's a fun one, little speculative. Do you think Lincoln would be on social media?
That's a great question. I think the problem with social media and the problem with cable television is we're on it within seconds. We react rather than take the time to respond. How many times have we, each one of us who's listening or watching, sent out a text or an email and a few minutes, "Oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't sent that." That's why Lincoln took his time, I think, to write these notes. And therefore, I think he would be pretty careful or even wary of social media.
I've heard people talk about how one of the pressures that social media puts on
us,
there's many, but one of them is this sense that we all have to have an opinion about everything.
It
feels sometimes like we're just surrounded by opinions, that we're walking opinions. That's all we are anymore. Right. Political opinions when it comes to this stuff. Lincoln had something he called, and this was his humor, I suppose, a public opinion bath.
Yes, he used the phrase public opinion baths. By what he meant was he wanted to hear what ordinary people meant. He kept office hours when he was president, a number of hours a week. And some of his aides said, why are you allowing all these people just to walk in and talk to you? I want to know what ordinary people think. These are my public opinion baths, not simply what Senator so-and-so or Governor so-and-so or whatever. What do ordinary people think?
Yeah, and it seems it was not a conventional thing at that point.
No, it wasn't.
I wonder if the temptation of social media, here's where everybody's talking, would have rolled him in, or whether he would have been, I don't know, wise, naive enough to say, maybe it's a little intense in there. I'm not sure. What do you think Lincoln would say to this moment of wild division? And there is one study that came from the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, and I want to share this because it's chilling. It reported that roughly 4 in 10 of Biden voters and about half of Trump voters at least somewhat agree that it's time to split the country, favoring blue or red states seceding from the Union. What would Lincoln say to this moment? What would he advise?
First of all, let's remember how Lincoln changed our language. Before Abraham Lincoln, up until the time of his presidency, it was the United States are. The basic reality was the state. The nation was less important for some than the state. Lincoln changed our language. The United States is.
No way. He did that?
Really? The United States is.
That's amazing.
He talked again and again about the Union, which is a concept that we have a hard time getting our hands around. Wow. But this is why men signed up to fight the Civil War initially. It wasn't even to abolish slavery. It was to preserve the Union, this kind of mystical, transcendent body that was both political and religious, that we were a union. And so Lincoln was a person who would be aghast at the division between red and blue and would want to be a healing agent. The lawyer has the possibility of being a good man. This is what he wants to be. Yeah.
That's that line that sort of resonates. Can we see the goodwill?
Yeah.
Can we assume goodwill?
We assume goodwill. So he was a very good war president, but he was looking forward to a second term because I think he thought he could be a much better peace president because his whole point of view was reconciliation, forgiveness and reconciliation. That's what it's all about. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. Well, Ron, can't thank you enough for this time. Thank you for shining a light on Lincoln that we usually don't get, and Lincoln, the private person, and a person from whom each of us can learn something.
Yes.
I just thank you. Thank you so
thank
much
you
for bringing
very
him
much
down
for your
to
invitation.
Earth.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, in a minute here, I'm going to dissect that whole conversation with my friend April, who's a red to my blue. But first, a quick note on the subject of Ron's next book, due out in September. It's about Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, another hero of the Civil War, and I love this for two reasons. One, Chamberlain was a professor and president at my alma mater, Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. And two, Chamberlain led Union troops at the Battle of Gettysburg, and Gettysburg is where Braver Angels held our giant convention this summer. I was there with an equal number of Reds and Blues from across the country, all gathered at the site of the bloodiest battle of the Civil War to try to prevent another one. And so was my Braver Angels colleague, April. The thing about me and April, we vote for different sides. We disagree on loads of serious things. But when we talk, it tends to light up things for me that I wasn't seeing, and vice versa for her. So, we came up with a list of questions to ask each other as we trade takeaways around those big lessons from Mr. Lincoln. April, hello.
Hi there. It's so good to be here.
Yeah. So April is conservative, what at Braver Angels we call a red. Monica, myself, am liberal, what we call a blue. So we are here to dig into what got sparked by the conversation with Ronald White and the driving question for this episode, which is, how did Abraham Lincoln do it? How did he bridge divides? April, just real quick, just to kick us off, like, what was a favorite moment for you from this particular conversation?
Yeah, so there were lots, but I think my favorite was the moment where Ronald White tells the story of how Stephen Douglas had just debated Lincoln and Lincoln at this train platform and I guess looking awkward and doesn't know what to do with his hat and cane. And so Stephen Douglas says, oh, sir, may I hold those for you?
He said that was at the inaugural, actually. Oh, it was at the first inaugural, right before he was giving the speech. But yes, go on, because this is awesome.
Okay, so I loved that because that was a gesture that like shows a kind of grace and humility. Like it was an outward manifestation of something internal that I thought was really powerful. So
yeah,
how about you?
Totally. I really loved, as you could probably tell from my voice listening, when Ron made the point that it was Abraham Lincoln who changed our language about our country. From apparently we used to say, I didn't know this, we used to say the United States are, right? Like a plural. Huh. And he, in his speeches, changed it to the United States is. And so he literally made us one. He made us a unit. And as someone who like cares a lot about language, that really stood out to me.
Huh. I bet. Yeah. No, I agree. That was totally fascinating. We could probably learn from that. Let's move on to our second question, which is where does the driving question for this episode show up in your own life? So the driving question for this episode is, how did Lincoln do it? Where does that show up for you, Moni?
Yeah, well, these heroes of ours, we have them in a bunch of places. Like the first time that I went to DC and saw the Lincoln Memorial, I just realized, okay, we're holding this guy up and we're holding him up at Braver Angels. And then they become these sort of mythic figures and they don't seem real. They don't seem like they actually existed. They're just in our history books.
Totally. Totally.
And so the thing that made me think of actually as I was reflecting on this is Obama.
Oh.
Because when Obama was running for office, I don't know if I've ever told you this. Mm. I was so unbelievably moved.
Really?
I was one of those like young people swept up into the whole thing. And what I saw in Obama was this person who is so much like higher than most people that can speak in a way that I feel like he's speaking not only to me, but to everybody else. And I was right there on the whole hope and change. I was right there. And I remember how swept up I felt and how sure and confident that his leadership was really going to take us so far. And it didn't quite work out that way. And now that I know many more conservatives, like, yeah, that was one perspective. But I do, it just makes me go, these mythic figures, who are they really and what do they really think? So yeah, how about you? What came
interesting.
Up for you?
Well, I love that story because it speaks to the way that it can feel to be really inspired by a great leader. If you, of course, see these people as great leaders, which with Obama, some of us do and some of us don't. But I appreciate that. And I know that a lot of my peers felt that way when I was in college with Obama. So I like what you said about how these people become these mythic figures, and it's hard to remember. Like, frankly, it was sort of weird while I was like doing this, preparing for this, to think about Abraham Lincoln as a person. And I was like, how did he do it? He was Lincoln. Of course he could do it. Oh, wait, you mean he was a person like me? Oh.
Yeah.
And what I then thought about is the thing that I think that is in some ways most inspiring about Lincoln is that he somehow eradicated slavery and did it in a way that also was like holding the Union together. And honestly, what it makes me think about is, I don't think I've ever said this to you, but I ask myself like, okay, you're a bridge builder. What is the slavery of your day? What is the thing that you're not seeing, that you're not fighting for? And I think the answer is abortion. And because if you believe that we're killing children, then it is clearly the worst moral atrocity of our time.
And I've heard I've heard some comparisons to that it is a moral atrocity. So say more, because I really want to hear more about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just going to share how I have not always been pro-life because, among other things, I have not always been religious and I haven't always believed in souls and things. And I remember there was a moment when I was probably 24 when I just realized that like I was raised vegetarian. I like think that animals ought to be treated well, all these things. And like, I realized that, like, by the logic that I believe, I really, really, really should be pro-life. And so, but I didn't want to be because it has this horrible meaning, right? It means that we're, that our country is like permitting the murder of children. And so I asked a friend of mine who I knew was pro-life. I said, push me on this. I need to be pushed. I don't want to go there, but I know I need to. And so then I asked him, you know, I'm somebody who mostly tries to build bridges in politics and stuff, but this is a case where activism, it may be the only ethical thing to do. And so somehow we have this leader, this president, who like can witness a moral atrocity, fight for it to be healed, and still be a bridge builder. And that is amazing to me. So that's what it brought up for me, is just that question.
Wow. And I can't imagine that experience. I mean, as a blue, right, I hear that and I feel very much implicated in what you're saying, because, and you and I have talked about, you know, murder and abortion, and
yeah,
it's a conflict within me, but I know that I come down on the side of pro-choice.
Right.
And so when I hear, you know, my red friends like you talk about this, it's funny because there's a piece of my heart that knows exactly what you're saying.
Mm.
And there's a piece of my heart that goes, wait a minute, are we sure? So I'm sure that this is not going to be the last that this comes up for you and me.
No, it's not. It's complicated. This whole thing is so complicated. We will talk more about this, I'm sure.
Absolutely will.
Yeah.
Let's move to our third question, which is a nice meaty one, where we start speaking in, we give ourselves the liberties to speak in generalities about our entire side, which, if you know Braver Angels, you know that we don't really mean in a certain way. Like, everyone at Braver Angels speaks for themselves. You're not supposed to affix to a label. Like, we're here to try to get us away from that kind of thinking. Then again, it's also really interesting to hear people from a side just talk about what is meaningful about their side to them. So this is what we're going to do when I ask you this question, April, as a red, and then I will answer it as a blue. What do you think your side is good at when it comes to the strategies that have come up, and what's it not so good at?
Yeah. So I really appreciate that framing of it. And I think the core thing for Lincoln was intellectual curiosity and humility. And I think that a thing that Reds do well in this area is that we explicitly value those things. We talk about humility, we talk about character, we talk about intellectual curiosity, all of that stuff. And we don't scoff at those things. We don't simplify them. We don't even critique them that much. And so I think that just being able to explicitly name those things and explore them is really helpful.
And so that's a thing that's good.
Yeah.
A thing I think my side is good at is giving voice to the voiceless, which is interesting given what you just said about abortion. But I hear Lincoln and how, as the first Republican president, he did bring our country out of slavery in a big way. And even though people in his society, it was very controversial in a lot of circles to talk very openly and directly about this is a moral atrocity, slavery is a moral atrocity. But yeah, the blue side I appreciate because I feel like we have a certain radar for who's powerless and who doesn't seem to have a voice and who might be being harmed. And our, you know, our politics seem to be a lot about that. And so that's something I saw in Lincoln that I thought was really good. But again, I recognize the nuance brought up with what you said before about, like, you feel to you that it's the red side in something that is a moral atrocity and to you, dehumanizing thing going on today. So I find that really fascinating and I'm going to munch on that. So what would you, go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, I just really appreciate you acknowledging that nuance because it goes through my head every time blues say we're good at speaking for the voiceless. And I just appreciate, I mean, you don't have to agree with me, but I so appreciate you acknowledging the complexity.
So April, what do you think your side, the red side, is bad at when it comes to the strategies that you heard about?
Yeah, I think that we do a good job of talking about humility and intellectual curiosity and those things. But honestly, I don't think we always live it. In fact, I think that particularly the intellectual curiosity piece, frankly, when I am in a lot of circles where people talk about, oh, the social justice activists, the leftists, they want to make trans all the kids and make everyone politically correct and all this stuff. And I don't very often hear them say, but where are they really coming from? Like, they might know something I've missed. I see mostly defensiveness. And the risk, right, of talking about virtue is that then you open yourself up to hypocrisy when you don't leave it out. And I think we've got some of that, in all honesty. How about you? What about blues?
I want to add a caveat, because as I'm sitting here thinking about that particular bit of friction, right, mm-hmm. that's come up already with this, is I do really want to recognize and register that I think that the blue side does look at, with the abortion issue, the harm that comes to women.
To women, yes.
Mm-hmm. comes to women. And so mm-hmm. it's
just very real too.
Very, very real. And that's the thing with really complicated issues. Mm-hmm. There's more than one stakeholder, and mm-hmm. sometimes it can be hard to wrap your heart around all of it at once. Mm-hmm. So what I think the blue side is pretty bad at came right up, and it reflects what you said. I think the red side is good at this. I think the blue side can be extraordinarily unhumble, just remarkably unhumble. And what I'm thinking about is elitism, the charge of elitism on the blue side, where, and I can say for myself, I chase credentials, right? I've
sure.
gotten my degree. I've uh-huh. gotten my fellowships. I see how it opens doors. Uh-huh. And I get that invitation every time to feel superior. So I see that, right? And mm-hmm. I see it on the blue side, the sense that which is not to say that reds are not educated, but there mm-hmm. there is in the blue side this sort of academic kind of, like, mm-hmm. we're so educated, we're so well-informed.
Yes.
And therefore, that's it. We have everything we need. And so I think what happens is that we forget easily that wisdom doesn't come from book knowledge or even intelligence about stuff. Mm-hmm. It comes from intelligence about life, which is something that every human being who lives life is eligible to get, right? So yeah, when I hear Lincoln mm-hmm. calling himself a humble servant and seeming to really live into the idea that he's a humble servant to everyone, like mm-hmm. Ron White talked about the public opinion baths, right? He would go and listen. He went and listened to regular people. He wasn't somebody who thought, well, I'm only going to hang out with, like, you know, the big hot shots.
Right.
He was one of the first people to ever really do that when he held that much power. Mm. And that's really inspiring.
Totally. So. Totally. I love that. And I just want to say again, I really appreciate you being willing to see some of those things because it's funny, we said mirror images, right? Unhumble and intellectual curiosity. Like, so it really isn't all on one side. And, but it's helpful that people can see that when it's you on the other side. So thank you.
Yep.
So let's move on to our final question, which is, and I really like this one too. It's, what is a tactic that you glean from this interview that feels personally challenging to you and how you bridge divides?
Yeah, so I think it was just a small moment in what Ronald was saying, but I read the whole book that he wrote about Lincoln, and these fragments that Lincoln left of his personal thinking, a lot of them end mid-sentence. So what Ronald says is, like, well, I'm pretty sure what happened here, right? Because I've studied his life, is he would be there reflecting, making this entry and really thinking hard about something. And then someone would come in the room and he would just stop and he would leave it exactly where it was. And when I think about that, I'm like, yeah, I don't do that.
What do you do?
I don't do that. What I do is, if I'm really in my own head or I'm really, like, reflective or whatever, I put that first. Someone comes in the room, what they see from me is what you see from, like, the bad business executives in movies, like a raised finger, like, no, don't talk to me. Don't talk to me yet until I'm done. So my husband tells me this, that when I'm in work mode or in think mode and I'm on my own, like, he's a little scared. He doesn't want to counter. So I really admire Lincoln for being able to put the pen down, no matter how important. Because in some cases, it was really cool stuff. And it would have been really nice if the man had finished his sentence.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't. And, you know, history has to deal with the consequences.
That's a really powerful insight. Good job noticing. It's cool.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what felt like it was a challenge for you?
Yeah, so for me, it really is still the thing I brought up earlier around living in curiosity versus living in activism. Mm. I think that if Lincoln were alive and I were around him a lot for some reason, to carry his hat perhaps, that I would get frustrated with him often because half the time he would be engaging in curiosity mode and I'd want him to be angry about slavery. And then the other half the time he'd be angry about slavery and I'd want him to, like, engage in curiosity mode. Oh, and I think the reason that I would be frustrated with him is that I'm frustrated with me about this. I don't know how to balance these things or how to integrate them. Like, what I actually think the right thing to do is to integrate them. It's to live in both, right? To have your firm moral convictions and be open to other people knowing something that you don't, having something to teach you, all of those things. But I find that pretty hard. And so I tend to switch between, like, curiosity, good listener mode and, like, moral activism mode. And I don't want to, I feel like there's almost condescension in it because it doesn't say to people, here's my heart. It just, mm-hmm. I just ask for theirs. And so I think I want to learn.
Wait, how is that condescending? How is that condescending?
It's actually fair. It's not that it is. It's that I think it can come across that way. I think it can.
If you're all restrained and you're not sharing.
Oh, that's so interesting. My mother would tell you, she's like, I didn't say this so that it would be interesting. What do you think?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can't just be observing me like a rat in a cage. Tell me, where are you? And
that's right.
Yeah, I'm working on that, on like bringing my heart into conversations, even when I'm kind of uncomfortable in them.
Right. Because curiosity can be, I've never said this before, but it's a little bit of a shield.
Okay. Exactly.
Well, I'm going to escape from having to meet this person's passion with my own.
Right.
By pulling more out of them. And that's great. And I get to learn and maybe they like it or whatever, but here I am not having to do that. Mm-hmm. And what's also funny to me about that is that I think you're right that sometimes when people show passion for something, they want that to be met with the passion from you. Well, but what if you disagree?
That's
what
exactly
if your passion
it.
Goes in the other direction? Yeah.
But I think I want that to show up more, because I feel like in our work, there's this risk that you can just become a sort of like neutral arbiter all the time. And that's not who any of us are. And nobody can be friends with that. Right.
Oh,
and
wow. Yeah.
Jeez. We can't learn.
That's true.
I think so. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Because then you're never opening up.
Right.
Not opening up. And Lincoln, by the way, was known as a pretty private person. A lot of the passion that came out in his notes, there just wasn't a lot of evidence in his conversations with friends, at least that they documented, which I found really interesting. So
it is.
Does that mean that he did all that entirely in solitude? A part of me can't believe that. I wonder with Lincoln if he had that distance because he was a leader. And because of his leadership position, you know how that can happen. It's a little isolating.
On the other hand, he clearly is a passionate person, right? Oh, and so I do wonder, somehow he balanced those things. And I just think that, frankly, I think that's the only answer, is because none of us can afford to check out. And this is where I would critique, again, myself with not bringing my heart to things. We need all the hearts. We need everybody. This stuff is too hard.
That's right. And we need the hearts to be able to be actually honest.
Right.
You know, not hiding behind a question, even though questions are great. You can't hide. Oof. No, that's really good. That feels like a challenge for me too, I'll be honest. So, all right. Well, thank you as always, April, for joining in on this. And we're going to do this again. And I'm excited. There's going to be a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Definitely.
Yes.
I can't wait.
All right.
Yeah.
See you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Whew. Well, that last challenge April brought up, that balancing curiosity with passion, hearing what someone else is saying, but also saying at full strength what you believe too, that's it, right? That's the whole project. And well, I hope it's clear that though April and I are considered experts in this work, we're still asking questions, y'all. We're still figuring it out. There is no end to what we can inspire each other to try or rethink. So I hope our conversation inspired something for you. And on that note, I want to introduce you to Jade. I met her on a trip to Austin, and she had something of the opposite issue April mentions above. She was passionate about her politics, fully so, but also pretty intolerant of anyone else's.
My name is Jade, and I live in a small town outside of Austin, Texas. So I spent most of my teenage years and my 20s very far on the left. And when I say very far, I mean very far. Pretty much any kind of caricature that you might see of somebody that is very far on the left, that was me. I even down to the purple hair and tattoos and, you know, that was me. When I got into college, pretty much any campus activist event I gravitated to. And I don't regret that at all. I'm very proud of some of the things that I was involved in. But, you know, speaking to just the style that I believed was going to help me achieve some sort of political outcome, it was just very, very confrontational. What started to change in me was when I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I really had to learn how to sit with people that think differently than I do and really learn how to be curious about why they see the world that way. In the summer of 2020, when things were heightened politically, socially, I really just was curious about a lot of people's stance on things. Not because I had a set of beliefs that I was really, you know, married to at that time, but I wanted to hear how some of my friends and people close to me, what they were really thinking. So I asked a particular friend, they had been posting a lot on social media about defunding the police. And I didn't know exactly what they meant by that. I called them up. I just, you know, said that I was curious about what they were posting and how they felt about what was going on and if they could clarify their position. And just that alone, that curiosity led to a very negative conversation where they immediately accused me of, you know, being racist, that the question in and of itself was racist. To me, it felt like we had just been kind of pulled apart by things that were happening in the broader culture, not even something that happened between us. And we were very close friends. And I kept saying that, you know me, this is Jade. We've, you know, been through really rough stuff together. You know who I am. You know, do you really think I'm this bad person? Because we might feel differently about a political issue. Because at that time, they weren't clear where I stood. I don't even think I was clear where I stood on all of it. I was trying to find that for myself. But, you know, the way that they interpreted it was that we were on different sides. Maybe one of the reasons that it was so painful is because it kind of felt like karma. I was very familiar with that tactic of shutting somebody down because I had used it so much myself. I would resort to name calling and insinuation to shut down an argument where I felt like I was maybe being intellectually challenged. And maybe not until that very moment had I realized how aggressive it was and how, you know, sabotaging it was to having these really kind of meaningful conversations. Something as simple as a post on Instagram was able to really wreak havoc in our relationship, and it's never fully recovered, unfortunately, and it's definitely been a painful thing for me. We have to get back to being curious and forgiving and having humility and allowing people to, you know, in my case, allowing people to grow and change and still being able to love them. Echo chambers are so incredibly boring. Having people shake it up and, you know, bringing people in who just have these wild ideas that you may not ever understand or believe, but just being able to sit with them and listen, it's great. You know, it's really a wonderful opportunity.
Echo chambers are so incredibly boring. I mean, yeah. And humility. You know, having enough humility to listen when it's really hard. Lincoln talked about it. Jade talked about it. I think we know there's something to it. Now, in each episode, we're going to bring you a story like Jade's, and I want to make clear that they're not all going to come from the same side or move in the same direction. This is not about liberals moving to the right, nor the opposite, nor coming to the middle or anything like that. You'll hear from conservatives, liberals, libertarians, and everyone in between. You'll hear, too, from people who struggle with all kinds of things around the divide. Arguments with family, fraying friendships, that need to be right, that fear of being wrong. The pitfalls are wide and so deep, and we are here to help you face absolutely all of them. This kind of work, it goes beyond strategies. It goes beyond skills and even stories. Sometimes you need a little art. So I'm thrilled to send you brave souls back to your worlds with a song. It's called A United State of Humanity by John Baker and Donna Elaine Miller, and it was the winning song in our first Braver Angels songwriting contest.
It's not black, it's not white, it's not wrong, it's not right, it's not red, it's not blue, it's just me and you.
And that's a wrap, folks. Thank you so much for joining us on this first episode of A Braver Way. I'm so glad you're here. A Braver Way is a production of Braver Angels. We get financial support from the MJ Murdoch Charitable Trust and Reclaim Curiosity. Our supervising editor is Sarah Lerner. Our producer is David Albright. Our theme music is by the fantastic bluegrass and hip-hop group Gangsta Grass. A special thank you to our contributor, April Lawson. I'm your host and guide across the divide, Monica Guzman. If you like what you're hearing, help us get the word out. Hit subscribe, give us a 5-star review, share the show with your friends and family all across the political spectrum. It would mean the world. Questions, comments, surprises? You can reach us at abraverway@braverangels.org. Take heart, everyone. Until next time.
But only if we decide we need a United States of humanity. We need it. We need it. A United States of humanity. The sum of every part. We need a United States of humanity. We need it. We need it. Resolutions in a revolution of the heart. It's not just the conversation. It's the listening. It takes every voice feeling heard to let freedom ring. We can solve our future, heal our history, sting, step toward our common ground, and spread our better angel wings. We need a United States of humanity. We need it. We need it. A United States of humanity. The sum of every part. We need. Is a revolution of the heart. Oh, we hold this truth to be self-evident. I have a dream, a United States of humanity. We need it, we need it. We hold this truth to be self-evident. I have a dream, a United States of humanity. In a revolution of resolutions, in a revolution of resolutions, in a revolution of the